Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Welcome back to the fifth talk in the audio course, Mindfulness Where Dharma Meets Practice, and the first talk on the topic, Living in Devotion. A popular adage states, you can lead a horse to water, but you cannot make him drink it. I can lead the listener to the Noble Eightfold Path and even offer oats a couple of talks from now, but will the listener drink it? The issue is one of motivation. Entering fully into Buddhist practice is one of those truly life-altering decisions. So it's critically important that deep, steadfast, unwavering, and wholesome motivation stands behind our practice if we're to carry through on that decision. In both general mindfulness and virtue, we've seen how motivation in our practice tends to come from finding satisfaction in fully inhabiting the practice task itself. It tends not to come from striving for some advantage beyond the practice task. We want to look in similar terms to the deeper currents of motivation behind all of our practice. Devotion, the motivator. Think about truly life-altering decisions. Think about the bold choices of the great explorers of virgin lands, of the hippies on a quest to India with nothing but a backpack, of people who buy an accordion and are determined to learn to play it, of people about to get married and raise a family, of those setting out on a new education or career path, and of those who bring home a new St. Bernard puppy. Most of us have made life-altering decisions, but do we ever know just what we're getting ourselves into? Such decisions generally arise from an initial sense of urgency, and this turns into a determination that requires entrusting ourselves to something we do not fully understand, and then persevering when the unexpected arises. This takes enormous courage. Such decisions are well beyond the reach of the timid or of the deniers who cling fearfully to their certitude. It requires that we boldly resolve, this will be the shape of my life, and then stick with it. What motivates such foolhardiness and then keeps it alive? The currents of motivation are deep, but we can tease out at least two key factors, trust and devotion. These must be present if we're to fully embrace Buddhist life. When these are present, we can expect that our practice and understanding will provide the primary meaning, direction, and outlook for our lives. Then into this, all other aspects of our lives will find their place. The Buddhist path is long, a lot of work, and at least initially without noticeable result. Those of great aspiration need to be on fire, much as scientists or artists can be on fire. Catching fire begins with trust and develops into devotion. Let's begin with trust. Trust, also translated as faith or sometimes confidence, fills the gap between the little we actually know and what we need to know to act with certitude. Trust is a necessary part of our choices, big or small, in all spheres of life. This is because we are karmic beings, that is, we are repeatedly called upon to act, but we have to do this with limited knowledge of an uncertain world. We have little certitude as to results. Trust can depend on the probability of desirable outcomes, as when we trust a friend's recommendation of a movie or of a dentist. but it can also depend on the absence of other viable alternatives, as when we have no idea where we are, so we have to choose to drive in an arbitrary direction and stick with this until we spot something familiar. Desperation is also like this and makes us trust with poor odds of success. With less calculation, we're often persuaded to trust by erratic factors such as a slick commercial or a salesperson, the bedside manner of a doctor, or the charisma of a preacher, or the beauty of a Buddhist statue. Religion and patriotism and certain institutions often demand a communal ritual avowal of trust or faith. The word I'm translating as trust actually implies a kind of wholeheartedness. This is an important motivation factor that is perhaps better served by the word faith, but I'm avoiding the word faith because it often implies in modern context something highly irrational. It's helpful in this regard to point out that trust in Buddhism serves as an encouragement for self-discovery that has nothing to do with blind faith. In fact, quite the opposite. Trust is likely to become firm as our practice of the Dharma establishes a strong track record. We'll get into this in more detail by the end of next week's talk. In fact, the Pali word we're translating as trust, Sadda, comes from a root meaning putting the heart on, so wholeheartedness. Making major choices out of low certitude trust but with wholeheartedness puts us in the realm both of greatest human foolhardiness but also of greatest human achievement. This is much as a scientist relentlessly pursues an initially unlikely path of investigation. Wholehearted trust comes with a level of motivation in excess of the odds. We best enter into Buddhist practice with the mind of the explorer of virgin lands. For most of us, Buddhism is a virgin land in which we over and over encounter the most unexpected things around the next turn in the path. We need a level of commitment to run with the choice we've entrusted ourselves to through thick or thin. Devotion is a sense of wholehearted commitment that motivates us to persevere in our choices as valuable in themselves. We've discussed motivational structure in two previous talks. Through mindfulness, we tend to inhabit the task as something satisfying in pursuing well, putting aside the utility of the task for some purpose out of the task itself. Through virtue, we find satisfaction and delight in living within the broadest standards of harmlessness, giving, and kindness, instead of striving toward personal advantage. Devotion has a similar motivational structure, but at the higher level of overall life commitment. The meaning of the Pali word for devotion ranges over clear, bright, and glad, as well as pious. It's through devotion that we completely inhabit Buddhist practice and understanding. This is why this talk is called Living in Devotion. As we live in devotion, we tend to lose me in the practice of Dharma itself. Of course, our practice and understanding do lead karmically to personal benefit. Aside from ending suffering, we may also have been told to hold other incentives in mind. That practice is a means to self-improvement, to less stress and anxiety, to rewiring the brain for happiness, to better sex, to mystical experiences, to better creativity or productivity, or to business success. These points may be true and be valid initiators of practice, but devotion allows us to put unskillful striving towards such benefits aside. Devotion is our primary motivator. It allows us to settle into and fully inhabit our practice. Practice has a communal context. Individual practice plays a key role in Buddhism. We are the heirs of our own karma. But the Buddha also recognized that humans are social beings and that our trust and devotion will take root primarily through the influence of others. It's important that we associate with the right people. An admirable friend is a wise person who is well informed of the Dharma, lives according to Dharma, and whose words and conduct are a source of inspiration for others. In effect, in early Buddhism, admirable friends were the teachers. They teach by example, if not by word. We're likely to learn the most from people of high attainment or spiritual progress. The importance of the admirable friend is expressed in a curious passage. As he was seated to one side, Venerable Ananda said to the Fortunate One, "This is half of the holy life, Lord, having admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues." "Don't say that, Ananda, don't say that, having admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues is actually the whole of the holy life. When a monk has admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path." Admirable friends have themselves already entered deeply into virtue and wisdom. It's through these admirable friends that the meaning of the Buddha's life and awakening is revealed, and through these admirable friends that the Dharma is clarified step by step. This leads the student toward and along the path. We should seek out and befriend those in Buddhist communities whose practice we would do well to emulate. Besides this, the Buddha created the Sangha, which is at core the monastic community, where such adepts are trained, but also including lay, that is non-monastic, Buddhist adepts of great attainment. The Sangha serves to uplift the wider community by fulfilling three social functions. First, the Sangha is a source of admirable friends. Just as it benefits us to have artists and good plumbers among us, or good citizens, it ennobles us to have saints and sages, adepts, and awakened people in our midst. They make up an effective civilizing force. Second, the monastic Sangha provides an ideal context for Buddhist practice for those who want to pursue the holy life as far as possible. It does this by defining the life most conducive to upholding Buddhist principles, a life so barren of any opportunity for personal advantage that a me can scarcely find a footing. Third, the monastic Sangha is charged with the continuity of the Buddha's teachings. It plays a role much like the faculty of a university. Without full-time staff, scholarship would become anemic if it were to survive at all. The flourishing of the monastic Sangha ensures that there will be admirable friends of great attainment. The Buddha stated, in fact, that if the monks should live the life to perfection, the world should not lack for awakened ones. Keeping the flame of the Dharma burning bright is critical for the perpetuation of the teachings in their full integrity for future generations. Those teachings are subtle and sophisticated, but this means that they are also easily misinterpreted and get corrupted if they are not sustained by practitioners of attainment. In short, admirable friends tend to invoke trust and inspire wholeheartedness and devotion. The root definition of Sangha is the monastic community of both monks and nuns, but the Buddha extended the word Sangha also to refer to some non-monastics, to noble lay people who have entered into at least the initial stage of awakening called stream entry. In short, it's a concentration of highly qualified, admirable friends who tend to evoke trust and to inspire us to wholehearted devotion. Refuge. The devout Buddhist focuses trust in three sources of wisdom, which we trust to guide us in our spiritual development and in how we conduct our lives. These three sources of wisdom are the Buddha, who is the awakened one, the historical founder of Buddhism, the Dharma, which is what the Buddha taught, or a functionally faithful representation of what the Buddha taught, and the Sangha, which is either the community of monastics or the noble Buddhist adepts, monastic or lay. The Triple Gem refers to these three sources of Buddhist wisdom: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Refuge is wholehearted devotion to the wisdom of the Triple Gem. Refuge is based not only on trust in the Triple Gem, but also on trust in our own capacity for practice and awakening. Trust in the Triple Gem is what first turns our heads resolutely toward virtue, wisdom, and serenity. It will grow progressively more discerning and acquire more depth as we repeatedly have the opportunity to check things out in our own experience. At some point, it'll turn to devotion. At that point, we may be determined to master the practice. The Dhammapada says, "He who has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and his Sangha penetrates with transcendental wisdom the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the Noble Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of suffering." On the basis of refuge in the Triple Gem, we open our hearts and minds to the influence of the teachings of the Buddha. We then begin to study, practice, develop, and gain insight into them. Refuge is the center of our devotion. It is a home we inhabit in lieu of unwholesome striving, not just a place we would rather be. It feels like a safe and nurturing context in which our practice unfolds. The word refuge means a place of safety, and Triple Gem carries the same implications. Gems in ancient India were regarded as having protective powers. Devotional practices in Buddhism. The practice of devotion gives mindfulness a key role as we bring our values and particularly the Triple Gem repeatedly to mind so that they become an ever-present support for our path practices, a promoter of depth and ardency. Devotional practices are verbal, mental, and even bodily. They give Buddhism much of its appearance of religiosity. I should acknowledge that many modern Buddhists and would-be Buddhists reject whatever smells of religiosity. Buddhism as a religion is certainly an outlier, and many would like to leave it that way. For these, I point out that every element of religiosity has its equivalent in common secular contexts as well. For instance, in sports, in the military, and even at birthday and dinner parties. Also, these elements are rather thin in early Buddhism, and as with path practices, they have well-established functions for the benefit of practice. No further justification should be necessary. About verbal refuge. Refuge is meant to be borne constantly in mind as the backdrop of the rest of our practice. One way to develop mindfulness of refuge is through daily recitation, explicitly to reflect on the qualities of the Buddha, the Dharma, and of the Sangha, traditionally by bringing formulaic texts to mind and reciting them aloud. Repetition helps us bear our devotion to the Triple Gem more readily in mind. Some qualities of the Buddha are that he's rightly self-awakened, consummate in knowledge and conduct, well-faring, an expert regarding the world, unexcelled as a trainer for those to be trained, the teacher of all, awakened, fortunate. This refers, in short, to his attainments of virtue, wisdom, and awakening, to his skills as a teacher, and to his benefit in having discovered the path. Some qualities of the Dharma are that it is well taught by the Buddha, visible, timeless, inviting verification, leading to progress, to be realized by the wise for themselves. This refers to the empirical nature of the Dharma, to its provenance, and to its function. We'll explore some surprising and rather inspiring qualities of the Dharma in more detail next week. Some qualities of the Sangha are that it practices well, uprightly, systematically, and skillful, is worthy of support and of respect, and it is a field of merit. It is also critical for the propagation and perpetuation of Buddhist teachings. This refers to the quality of monastic practice and how the laity properly relates to monastics and to the historical role of the Sangha since the time of the Buddha, without which the Buddhist teaching we now enjoy would scarcely have survived. In addition to the mindfulness of the triple gem, the early discourses recommend that we reflect similarly on our own practice of the precepts, on our own giving, and on the heavenly realms. The heavenly realms are often used in reference to the karmic fruits of our actions and are therefore associated with purity. Each of these six mindfulness practices produces similar results, leading to mental composure. When a noble disciple recollects the Buddha, on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by lust, aversion, or delusion. On that occasion, his mind is simply straight based on the Buddha. A noble disciple whose mind is straight gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dharma, gains joy connected with the Dharma. When he is joyful, delight arises. For one with a delighted mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes composed. You should develop this recollection of the Buddha while walking, standing, sitting, and lying down. You should develop while engaged in work and while living at home in a house full of children. What is said here about the Buddha is then repeated, but with regard to the Dharma, the Sangha, precepts, giving, and heavens. As for the practice of virtue, mindfulness of the triple gem gives rise to the same progression. Delight gives rise to tranquility, gives rise to mental composure. Although we're looking at refuge primarily as a motivator for path practices, this passage tells us that refuge in itself produces roughly the same immediate fruits as path practices. We should understand that benefits accrue from devotional practices across the board and across religious traditions that we do well to respect. It's been shown empirically that the devoutly religious enjoy significantly improved mental and physical health, happiness, calm, and a sense of well-being and strong social bonds. About bodily refuge. We enhance refuge through verbal recitation, but even more so through putting our bodies into it. Buddhists take a page out of the playbook of puppies who train for the abstract possibility of future fierce battles by putting their whole bodies and minds into play. This is a basic function of ritual in which actions have a meaning beyond mere physical postures, just as gentle nips mean violent chomps for the puppies, meanings that are embodied in the action. Refuge is similarly embodied through gesture. The Buddha was venerated in his lifetime through prostrations, circumambulation, covering one's otherwise bare shoulder, sitting in a lower seat, standing upon the Buddha's arrival, not turning one's back on him, nor walking ahead of him. These are formalities based on early Indian etiquette and well documented in the earliest texts. To bow to the Buddha, even now to bow to a statue, is to enact reverence for the Buddha with body and mind. To enact reverence for the Buddha is to re-experience refuge, that is, to open the heart and mind to the influence of the Buddha. Other practices venerate the Dharma. Many of the same physical expressions of veneration that applied to the Buddha have also been applied to the monastic Sangha and continue to be applied in the present day. Veneration toward the Sangha is, in a sense, easier today because it applies to the only living gem and therefore assumes a particularly personal quality. Although we are often dismissive of such devotional practices as bowing in modern culture, it's important that this, with time, be overcome for the benefit of our path practice. Ignoring devotional practices neglects a time-tested way we can better align with the Buddha's path. You will be surprised, as I once was, to discover how much bowing, for instance, brings to practice. Devotional ritual practices also dovetail with the cultivation of general mindfulness discussed as part of living in mindfulness. Because of the often elaborate and normative nature of rituals, they demand that we keep in mind what we are doing. At the same time, our karmic actions take on a kind of sacred quality, as if every action has an exclamation point after it.
Further resources related to this course, Mindfulness, Where Dharma Meets Practice, are available at Sitagu, that is Sitagu, sitagu.org/shortlinks/mindful.